From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As Congress returns to work this week, we'll examine Rehnquist's impeachment gavel. What would a Senate trial of the president look like? Presided over by the Supreme Court Chief Justice. Then, The Good Black, a true story of race in America. We'll talk to a corporate lawyer who sued his blue-chip law firm for racial discrimination. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton will propose the largest increase in defense spending since the end of the Cold War buildup of the 1980s in the budget he will send to Congress next month. If approved by Congress, the increase would fund the largest military pay increase since 1984 and a round of new sophisticated jet fighters, attack helicopters, and warships. Against this backdrop of the biggest increase in military spending since the Reagan era, President Clinton is also proposing to give a tax credit of $1,000 a year to people who need long-term care at home or in an institution. The credit would also be available in some cases to people who care for relatives with conditions like Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, stroke, and brain injuries. The American Red Cross says it will make a major news announcement today, lending credence to widely reported expectations that Elizabeth Dole, the organization's president, would resign, possibly as a first step toward running for the Republican nomination for president. A spokesperson for the Red Cross says she could not confirm a report in the new issue of Newsweek that Dole has decided to quit her job. The UN chief in Angola questioned yesterday the future of the world body's peace efforts there following the shooting down of a second UN plane with eight people aboard. This the second in a week. And the downing of this plane has drawn angry reaction from UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. He said in New York this weekend it was high time the Angolan government and UNITA called an immediate ceasefire, which will permit the conduct of search and rescue missions as well as the relocation of United Nations staff to safer areas. Annan said there can be no excuse for any delay on any side in disclosing all relevant information about the fate of the passengers and crews of the two UN aircraft. The United Nations gave the government and rebels in Angola prior notice of the flight plan for a UN chartered plane that was shot down. The plane was believed hit by anti-aircraft fire and went down after it took off from Huambo on Saturday with eight people aboard. This news from Turkey. Despite threats from Saddam Hussein, a U.S.-led force has resumed patrolling a no-fly zone in northern Iraq. A U.S. official says the flights were resumed yesterday after a two-day holiday break. Citing security concerns, the spokesperson for Operation Northern Watch wouldn't say whether the force, which includes British planes, flew today. United Nations officials have held talks with Iraq to try to persuade it not to ban American and British nationals working for the UN humanitarian program there. This, according to diplomats in Baghdad. They gave no details of the talks aimed at averting a new crisis just 2 weeks after the United States and Britain ended 4 days of airstrikes to punish Baghdad for what they said was non-cooperation with UN weapons inspectors. And President Saddam Hussein slammed Western-imposed no-fly zones over northern and southern Iraq as illegal and said his people would resist them with bravery and courage. This, according to the Iraqi news agency. It said Saddam, maintaining Iraq's recent strong challenge to the no-fly zones, told a cabinet meeting they were flagrant and clear-cut violations of international laws, accords, and norms, particularly the United Nations Charter. Saddam Hussein's statement was his first public comment on a series of clashes between Iraqi air defense units and warplanes patrolling the zone set up by Western forces after the 1991 Gulf War to limit his military power in northern Kurdish and southern Shiite regions. The exiled Saudi millionaire accused by U.S. officials of masterminding two embassy bombings is sending mixed messages about his role, telling one U.S. magazine he did not order the attacks and another that he instigated them. In interviews published in the issues of Newsweek and Time of January 11th, Osama bin Laden is consistent on two other subjects, defending the acquisition of weapons of mass destruction and denying that he is ill, as some U.S. reports have suggested. And the death toll in anti-military riots this weekend in Aceh, a troubled Indonesian province, rose to at least 9, as 2 more people were killed in East Timor, in the capital of Dili. Meanwhile, Chile's government will try to intervene in Britain's case against General Augusto Pinochet and is prepared to argue that all foreign courts lack jurisdiction over the former dictator.
Okay, Mr. and Mrs. Clinton, just sign these papers and the adoption is official.
This is so exciting.
We're going to be parents again.
Now keep in mind, he's totally helpless, drools, speaks gibberish, he needs to be told what to do and where to go, and sleeps constantly.
Well, that's no problem. Bring him in.
Will, I'm happy to meet you. My name is Ronnie.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. When Congress comes back to work this week, its first order of business will be the impeachment trial of the President of the United States, resuming a divisive process that's already brought months of anguish to the nation and its leaders. But as the venue changes from impeachment in the House to trial in the Senate, so too does the nature of the conflict. Before the Christmas intermission, the battle was joined on almost purely partisan grounds, as House Republicans, with minimal help from the Democratic minority, voted 2 articles of impeachment against President Clinton. Now the fight is within the Republican Party itself, with Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott trying to forge a bipartisan compromise on trial procedure in the face of opposition from the House prosecutors, some conservative senators, and the conservative interest groups who form much of the party's political base of support. I'm reading, actually, from an article in yesterday's Washington Post on the front page, which goes on to say that it's still unclear how Lott's dilemma, a crucial test of his own and possibly his party's political future, will be resolved. In addition to consulting with his colleagues, Lott has been talking with House Judiciary Committee Chair Henry Hyde about ways to proceed. Well, we're going to talk about just what a Senate trial would look like. We're joined right now by Bert Newborn. He is the John Norton Pomeroy Professor of Law and Legal Director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School, and wrote an article in the recent issue of Nation magazine called Rehnquist Impeachment Gavel. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy.
Hi. You know, I was trying to get a hold of this book, which I haven't been able to yet, but you did
it. It's out of print. I think it exists only in academic libraries, although I understand they're putting it back into print now.
That's right. I know some bookstores are calling for it, and that is the book that was written by the Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist, called Grand Inquest, The Historic Impeachments of Justice Samuel Chase and President Andrew Johnson. Well, you got a chance to read the book. What does it say, and what does it tell us about the direction you think that Rehnquist would go in if he presided over the Senate trial?
Well, the book is an entirely conventional history of the two major impeachment trials in the nation that we've ever had in the country. Thomas Jefferson tried to get rid of a Supreme Court justice in 1805, Samuel Chase, who was a particularly partisan Federalist, they managed to get a bill of impeachment through the House, and it failed by 4 votes in the Senate. That was the first major trial. Then, of course, the trial that everybody knows about was the trial in 1868, when they tried to remove Andrew Johnson as president, and that failed by 1 vote. And what Rehnquist has done is written a narrative, a kind of a day-by-day narrative of the two trials, so that you get, understand exactly what the evidence was, what the various documents looked like, and what the rulings of the chair were in both of those trials. So it's a helpful primer on what he sees the past is and how he's likely to behave himself when he presides over this trial.
And how do you think he's likely to behave?
He's going to be passive. The Constitution provides that when the president is impeached, the Chief Justice serves as the presiding officer. When anybody else is impeached, it's the vice president who serves. But since the vice president would have a personal interest in the outcome of any impeachment trial, he's replaced here by the Chief Justice. And the Chief Justice is sitting not so much as a judge, but as a presiding officer. And so he doesn't really have the kind of power that a judge has in a regular trial. He maintains order, he makes rulings, but every single ruling that the judge makes is appealable to the full body. And 100 senators will then vote on things like the admissibility of evidence, the sufficiency of the charges, all the things that a judge would ordinarily deal with in a trial quickly and crisply. In one of these Senate impeachment trials is an agonizing series of rulings that have to be voted on over and over and over again by every single member of the Senate.
The talk shows on corporate television yesterday were filled with senators, Republicans and Democrats, talking about what their hopes and dreams were for this next few weeks. And they were mainly talking about the speed with which a trial could take place. I mean, we've got the Gorton-Lieberman initiative, the proposal that the Democrat from Connecticut and the Republican from Washington have put forward. Maybe you could explain exactly what that is.
What Lieberman and Gorton have done is they've said, look, this trial really shouldn't go forward unless there's a chance that it could succeed. So what they want to do is they want to set up for an impeachment trial the equivalent of what in a real trial would be called a motion to dismiss, in that the House managers would be given a day, a full day, to present the outlines of their case. They would say, this is what we will prove if we're allowed to do so. The president's lawyer would then be given a full day to say, this is why those charges can't possibly result in removal from office. There'd be then one day for discussion and debate, and then on the fourth day, the Senate would vote. And unless the Senate voted two-thirds, unless they got 67 votes to say that this trial should go forward, that would be the end of the impeachment trial. Because people should remember, you can't remove a president from office on a majority vote. It was a majority vote in the House of Representatives in order to vote the bill of impeachment. But in the Senate, you must get two-thirds. You must get 67 senators to vote to remove the president from office. That means 12 Democrats have got to cross over and vote to remove the president from office. Everyone assumes that that is absolutely impossible, so that the Republicans and the House are up against a stone wall in the Senate. They cannot move forward and get him removed. And the question is whether they're going to be able to work out some mechanism that extricates themselves from this and allows there to be some sort of censure as a substitute for what is really a doomed effort at removing him.
We're talking to Bert Newborn, who is the legal director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School. But how can the senators vote to dismiss without considering all the evidence and hearing it?
What they could say, and I think this is what I hope they're going to say because it is so clearly right, they could say that the charges that have been made by the House against the president are charges of serious misbehavior. Perjury and obstruction of justice are serious things. But unless they are in some way connected to abuse of his office, that an impeachable offense, an offense by for which you remove an elected official, actually cancel the elections, has to be something that deals with the abuse of official power. You have to be misusing your office. That's what impeachment is for, to remove somebody from office who is misusing it. The other things like perjury in your private life or improper activity in your private life that allegedly violates the criminal law. Criminal law can take care of that. They could indict Clinton for perjury. They could indict him for obstruction of justice. The only question is whether the trial would go forward today or whether the trial would go forward in 2000 when he leaves office. So there's no need for impeachment. Impeachment is nuclear weapons here. Conventional weapons can deal with this issue quite easily.
Are there criminal charges that would rise to high crimes and misdemeanors?
Sure. Any criminal charge, for example, that dealt with abuse of your office. If, for example, this were perjury about the way the president was carrying out his official duties. When Nixon committed perjury back in 1973, he was lying about a break-in an unconstitutional break-in that he had helped orchestrate and was then covering up. He was abusing the powers of the presidency. And under those circumstances, impeachment is exactly what the founding fathers wanted, but not impeachment for private behavior.
So can it be something that happened before he was president?
Probably not, because if it happened before he was president, then it couldn't possibly involve the abuse of his office. It has to be somebody who is put into office and then uses that power improperly. That's what impeachment is for, to help us remove somebody who is improperly using his political power.
Let's talk a little more about Rehnquist, since you did review his book. I actually was curious. We did a whole show a week or two ago on the Supreme Court Chief Justice and about his racist background that went back to him being a conservative activist lawyer in Phoenix, Arizona, who attempted to stop African-Americans from voting or discourage them from voting against Brown versus Board of Education, against a number of desegregation cases, said that liberal judges have a pathological need to find discrimination. And I was wondering, in his assessment of Andrew Johnson, because here you had Andrew Johnson, who is against Reconstruction, against, basically for slavery and against blacks participating in civil society, how he viewed Andrew Johnson.
Well, he doesn't treat Johnson comfortably in the book. I mean, he does not turn Johnson into a hero. You could say that psychologically, because he is such a conservative and he has over the years been so suspicious of civil rights legislation, that he approaches the Johnson impeachment trial, which, after all, was a trial where the radical Republicans tried to remove Johnson from office because he fired Edwin Stanton, who was Lincoln's Secretary of War and who was attempting to allow blacks to vote in the newly as the states were being readmitted to the Union. Stanton was attempting to require that they be that blacks be allowed to vote. So you could say that somehow his politics color his view of history. But in fact, his view of history in the book is a very conventional view of history. He says that Johnson was inconsistent with Lincoln's policies. He does say that he was slowing down the Reconstruction process. And he does say that the radical Republicans were attempting to remove him precisely because of that. And in fact, they felt so strongly about it that they passed a statute forbidding Johnson from removing a cabinet officer without the consent of Congress. And that's what he was being impeached for, that he violated a statute that forbade him from removing a member of his own cabinet without congressional permission. Today, that would appear absolutely absurd. We all assume that a president can have whatever cabinet the president wants, although recently there have been some efforts by Congress to cut back on that.
You raise at least four important legal issues that would be raised by the Clinton impeachment trial. Among them, an issue that's been floating around, this issue of, is a bill of impeachment voted by a House in the closing days of a lame duck Congress legally sufficient to force an impeachment trial before a new Senate?
Yeah.
Can an old House pass something on to a new Senate?
Well, you would ordinarily think not. I mean, in order to have a bill passed, in order for something to be legislation in our system, it has to be passed by both houses during the same Congress. So if an old House passes a bill and then you've got a new Congress that comes in, the new House has to pass it also, as well as the new Senate. So the question is, why should a bill of impeachment be different? Why should and that's an open question. They've impeached a couple of judges on cross-house impeachments. But the two major impeachment trials, the Chase impeachment trial and the Johnson impeachment trial, both involved bills of impeachment that were voted by the same House. So this would be a completely open question.
Could Rehnquist rule on this at the very beginning and throw the whole thing out, or at least say that the new House has to now vote?
Well, I hypothesize in my piece that if Rehnquist were Earl Warren, that's just what he would do. He would step in, he would put an end to this, he would move to dismiss, he would encourage people to file a motion before him. He would say that this is inadequate notice here, that this is a stale bill of impeachment, and in any event it has to deal with official behavior, and he would move to dismiss it. That could then be appealed to the full Senate. But as a matter of practicality, that would be the end of it. If he were to do that, he could end this if he wished, but he won't. He won't because he's William Rehnquist and not Earl Warren. He will defer to the Senate and let the Senate do pretty much what it wants.
And you lay out very well in the beginning of your piece in The Nation the connection between Chief Justice Rehnquist and Ken Starr.
Well, sure. I mean, Rehnquist first was Nixon's chief legal strategist back in 71 when he was appointed. When he was made Chief Justice by Reagan in 86, he was the darling of the conservative movement. And he handpicked the three judges who then went ahead and chose Ken Starr. So he is an impeccable conservative. but he's also a relatively honest man. I mean, this is a guy who is committed to the rule of law, to democracy. If he's forced to preside, he'll run a fair trial. But a fair impeachment trial is an oxymoron. It's a political process. And to say that it'll be fair, I think, is impossible to guess.
Bert Newborn, if you could stay with us for another minute after we break for stations to ID themselves, I'd like you just to lay out what the Senate trial would look like and how it is different from a normal trial that we see in a courtroom or we've come to see on television, though those, I'm sure, aren't normal trials. Bert Newborn is the John Norton Pomeroy Professor of Law and Legal Director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School. And then we'll look at a story of race in America. We'll look at a new book that's come out just today. It's called The Good Black. And we'll talk to a corporate lawyer who sued his blue-chip law firm for racial discrimination. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
When I got to the Senate, I got to be the chair of Committee of Judiciary. I pass lots of laws that are quite PC, and I make sure not a one of them applies to me.
Not a solitary one of them applies to we.
I do this with impunity, and now I am the ruler of morality.
To be,
says he,
or not to be, that's a quote from Mr. Biden of Judiciary.
I think that it's awful when men harass. It's rude and despicable and shows no class. When I hire a receptionist, I want a lass who impresses me because she has a lovely ass. Resume.
To say what he really thinks of her would be too crass.
I check her assiduity.
If it's firm enough, I'll let her work for me.
We carefully assess if she is an asset to the rulers of morality.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we finish up our discussion with Professor Bert Newborn, who teaches at New York University Law School and is legal director of the Brennan Center for Justice. A trial, what it would actually look like in the Senate and how it would compare to what we're used to seeing in court.
Well, the big difference is that the senators sit as both jurors and finders of the law. It's a jury of 100 politicians sitting out there. Every ruling that the Chief Justice would make would be appealable to those 100 politicians. They'd have to poll them over and over and over again, voting on everything. The biggest difference, of course, would be testimony. If they actually go to a full-scale trial the way the conservative Republicans want, there'll have to be full-scale testimony because, don't forget, nothing in this case so far has been subjected to cross-examination. All of the evidence against the president was developed in a grand jury room where only the prosecutor was present and no witness has been cross-examined. So if they put them on, they have to go on live. They will have to actually testify and be cross-examined with 100 senators being allowed to ask questions. And they can ask questions, at least under existing Senate rules, by passing a note to the Chief Justice. And the Chief Justice will read their questions so that 100 senators are going to question all of these witnesses. If they actually go forward with the trial, it may not end for 6 months. And that means that the Senate really has no choice. They need a way out of this, probably more than Bill Clinton does at this point.
So do you think it's unreasonable what we're hearing, senators, Republicans, and Democrats saying that, although the Republicans are saying it more, that this could take a week or two?
Impossible. If it goes to a trial, it is literally impossible to have a trial in this situation in less than several months. I mean, the Johnson case, which was a relatively cut-and-dried fact pattern, took a full month. This will take 6 months if it goes to trial, and we'll be lucky to get out of it with 6 months.
And these people who would testify, presumably, what, Monica?
I mean, it's the cast of characters. I mean, Lewinsky, Betty Curry, Vernon Jordan. They'd even have to bring Linda Tripp in, an exhibitor to the country once again. I mean, it would be everybody who testified before.
But it wouldn't necessarily be exhibiting them to the country because they could testify behind closed doors.
The Senate could try, but can you imagine the national outroar if they attempted to hold a trial on the removal of the President of the United States in secret? There's just no way they can get away with doing this in secret. If this goes forward, I said in my book, review of Rehnquist's book, it's going to be bad farce. We're going to have 6 months of bad farce, terrible government, and of course for the Republicans, suicidal politics, because they are digging themselves into a terrible hole here.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Bert Newborn, again, teaches at New York University Law School and is head of the legal director of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU.
Thank you
for being with us.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
And then we evaluated Clarence T. to see if he was worthy as a nominee. He had his subpoenas. He had to answer me by explaining just how long is his pedigree.
To this member, it's a matter of enormity.
Now Jesse Helms is mad at me,
and he's cutting off the funding for judiciary.
This ding-dong hearing ought to see a condemnation
as pornography.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, actually more specifically, The Capital Steps and their CD, Fools on the Hill. Well, we're going to move now from the issue of impeachment to the issue of racial discrimination and a new book that's come out today called The Good Black, A True Story of Race in America. Larry Mungin was raised in a housing project in Queens and made it his life's goal to excel and to dream of another life, to be a good black, as he defined it, one who wasn't one of the complainers. He studied hard, earned 2 degrees from Harvard College and then Harvard Law School, and went to work in a corporate law firm. Mungin thought his future was secure when he joined a blue-chip Washington law firm that was actually based in Chicago. 2 years later, he sued the firm for race discrimination in an explosive case that went to trial and ended in a surprising twist. When the trial was over, so was Mungin's corporate law career. His estrangement from the mainstream grew deeper when, in a highly unusual ruling, a 3-judge appellate panel entirely reversed the $2.5 million jury verdict. 2 white Republican judges ruled that no reasonable jury could have found discrimination. The black chief judge of the appeals court dissented. Larry Mungin found himself without the money and without the law career he'd worked for his entire life. He joins us now on Democracy Now!, as well as the man who wrote the book about him, Paul Barrett, who is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal and was his Harvard Law School roommate. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
Well, it's very good to be with you both, and I really look forward to this discussion. It's not only a discussion about your life, Larry Mungin, but also really gives us a look, an inside look at what a corporate law firm is all about, as something that a lot of us don't get a chance to look at. Why did you go to law school, and why did you end up being interested in corporate law, Larry Mungin?
Well, first, I would like to say that this is certainly Paul's book, and Paul decided to write it. I didn't want it written. I didn't want any publicity. I did it pretty much. I ended up cooperating, but pretty much against my will, ultimately, it was written. And only at this point have I really decided to discuss the issues in this context. I decided to go to law school because that was something I had always grown, always believed was an appropriate career for someone who wanted to have a serious life and a serious lifestyle. And certainly when I was at Harvard College, a lot of my friends had moved on to the law school. And for me, that seemed to be the logical next step. It would offer a lot of opportunities for different choices down the line. It wouldn't be closing any doors, and I think a lot of law students do view the career of law that way.
When you decided to go to law school, did you have any interest in pursuing, for example, civil rights law?
No. I do think I wanted a more comfortable existence, if you can call it that. Civil rights law was not something I was interested in at that time, although obviously ultimately I was compelled to learn a lot more about it than I had ever dreamed.
Mm-hmm. Paul Barrett, why did you decide to write this book? I mean, it's very interesting. It's not just a book for you. I mean, Larry was your law school roommate.
That's right. The short answer as to why I wrote the book was I'm a newspaper reporter, and a terrific story took place right in front of me in which the central character was someone who I'd known for 15 years and respected and was interested in just on a human level. Larry and I had first met 15 years earlier at Harvard, and he had been telling me about aspects of his life story for that entire period. And now suddenly his life story had collided with one of the most important social issues in the country. And if you're a journalist and you see that happening in front of you, you're almost compelled to write it. The way Larry said he was compelled to learn about the civil rights laws. You have no choice.
Larry Mungin, tell us what happened after you went to Harvard Law School.
Well, after I, at the law school, or once I was out starting my career.
Once you started your career.
Once I started, I started with several firms, one down in Houston, a terrific firm, Weil, Gotchel & Manges, a New York firm in the Houston office, had a great time, learned a lot, very important experience, and then I moved to an Atlanta firm, which ultimately moved me up to D.C. And while in D.C., I was a sixth-year associate moving into partnership range, and I saw better opportunities at a firm, the firm that I ultimately sued. And I went to this particular firm with an understanding that the following year I would be coming up for partner, eligible for partner, and that I would be reviewed accordingly, just like everyone else. And, of course, to my surprise, once I became eligible, I found that I was ignored and was not reviewed and somehow was told that although there was a formal process, that I had slipped through the cracks.
So give us a little more of a description of Catton Muchin, this blue chip Chicago law firm that you ended up working in its Washington office of.
Well, it's a very important Chicago firm with a lot of connections, very, very large, and they had a D.C. office and still have a D.C. office. And I was invited to join to help out with their bankruptcy practice, which they had hoped to enlarge and hoped to make it into something a little bigger and better than it actually was. And once I got there, I discovered that the work that they had for me was not quite what I had imagined. And after the first year, when I was eligible for partner, I started making inquiries as to what my partnership chances were. Was I going to be reviewed and treated in a way that my understanding was that the other associates in my class were being reviewed and being treated.
And what?
Go ahead. And Paul does a terrific job, much more than I was willing to go into it. He did the full investigation, did the full report of the law firm, the circumstances surrounding coming up for partner, what the procedures were for partnership at this particular firm. And as for me, my position was I felt I knew what I was entitled to, and was less inclined to report on it after. So my feelings about the whole coming up for partnership and my ultimate treatment are fairly strong, but less. Paul was in a much better position to analyze it than I was, mm-hmm. the total circumstances.
Right, and the whole process of what it means
yes.
to become a partner. But in terms of your perspective, when did you start to feel that race was coming into play in your lack of movement forward in the firm?
Well, certainly at the beginning, race was an issue. I mean, I was the only black in the office, and I ignored that simply because I always tried to ignore those. I always tried to ignore that as a possibility because I feel that it's a little too easy to focus on that, and ultimately it can hold you back. But clearly when I signed on, we had discussed the fact that there were no black attorneys in the D.C. office, and again, I decided to ignore that. But I did keep one watchful eye open. There was another race discrimination suit against the firm I discovered after I'd signed on by a partner in the Chicago office. And then about a year into my tenure at the firm, I was coming up for partner, and I started looking more closely at the numbers of black partners and what my chances were. I also was actively involved in trying to get some more black associates hired in the D.C. firm and met a brick wall in that effort. I'm not necessarily saying that there were racial reasons why these particular associates were not hired, but the isolation that I continued to feel as I came up for partner increased as I could not get any other blacks hired.
Mm-hmm. And what made you ultimately decide to go for the race discrimination suit?
Well, I had several other causes of action, ultimately, breach of contract, wrongful termination, but the civil rights causes of action were the ones that ultimately did withstand summary judgment. I felt I had no choice. I mean, I couldn't get reviewed. I came up for partner. I was ignored. I didn't get evaluated. I insisted on an evaluation. I eventually was able to get a flight out to Chicago to talk to the people who were supposed to be reviewing me and supposed to be making these decisions. And once I got out there, I was told that that I had slipped through the cracks and that they still weren't ready to evaluate me, and I should just sit and hold tight. And for me at that particular point in time, that answer was not appropriate. And so I felt I had no choice at that particular time.
Paul Barrett, as Larry Mungin said, you did do a very good job of laying out what his complaints were and also how that fit into the whole process of being chosen as a partner in a corporate law firm. A lot of our listeners may not be aware of what that whole process is and also how you would tease out what is just plain being treated badly from being racially discriminated against.
Right. Well, the partnership process in most law firms is a very complex and often kind of mysterious one. I think what was critical in Larry's case was not that he wasn't promoted. He never claimed he had a right to be promoted, but it was that he wasn't considered, that there was a process in place. There were internal firm documents that talked about the various ways that younger lawyers would be evaluated, how they would be introduced to clients, how they would basically be brought along by the more senior lawyers. And that whole series of events simply didn't happen in Larry's case. And that's characteristic of this whole story. It's not a story of epithets written on the wall, smoking gun documents. It's a story about silences, about failures to invite Larry to key social or business events. It's about work assignments being mysteriously and without explanation rooted away from him and toward other lawyers. In this case, it pretty much goes without saying to white lawyers. It's about a whole series of things that didn't happen. And in effect, Larry, despite his efforts to try to seek the type of guidance that any younger employee in this situation would seek, was treated, to borrow the phrase, like an invisible man. It was as if he wasn't there. And I think that is very much the story in professional workplaces today. You're not going to hear people shouting nasty names at each other. The point is there'll be somebody sitting in the corner who seems not to be involved in the day-in, day-out activities of the organization. And too often, disproportionately, I think you'll find that person will be African-American.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very important point that you raise, one that women and people of color know well, and it's not being a part of the old boy network, really. Because, I mean, you're talking about the kind of situations like parties, and you think, well, is business getting transacted there?
Of course the answer is yes, and particularly in a business like law. Law is a business of personal relationships. It's not a business of scientific formula. It's not a business of putting up physical things like a bridge or building a computer system. It's about people persuading one another. It's about people arranging business deals. It's about dealing with people's and companies' troubles. And that's done frequently face-to-face. If someone is seen as being a little bit out of step with the mainstream of the organization, that person's going to be in deep, deep trouble. Often, people in that position don't have the good common sense to speak up, to take a deep breath and say, pay attention to me. I want to work here. I want to succeed. In this instance, Larry did that. And still, he was basically left to one side. And when enough incidents had piled up, I think my impression was he felt compelled to do something about it. After a long life of swallowing many small slights and having many seemingly small incidents that troubled him. This was one time too many, one bargain that was broken that he felt needed to be kept. And so he took a deep breath and did something that had tremendous risk, and it had the result that it had. I mean, he sacrificed his corporate law career by filing this lawsuit.
Larry Mungin, I'll give you a chance to get your word in there in just a minute. We're going to have a break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll find out about the largest verdict in a discrimination case involving a black lawyer at a large corporate law firm, and then find out what happened to that verdict. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we talk to Larry Mungin, who is profiled in a new book called The Good Black, A True Story of Race in America by Paul Barrett, who joins us as well. Stay with us. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation about a true story of race in America, a new book that's just been published today called The Good Black. And we're joined by Larry Mungin, who is profiled in this book. It's his story. And also Paul Barrett, who is a Wall Street Journal reporter and who wrote the story of actually his law school roommate. Larry Mungin was Paul Barrett's law school roommate. And we're talking about a case that ended up with the largest verdict in a discrimination case involving a black lawyer in a large corporate firm. And that's the direction I want to go right now. Larry Mungin, tell us about how you ultimately decided to sue the law firm you chose. And the fact that you were so isolated also made it tough for you to really know what to do.
Well, that's exactly right, Amy. And that's why the incidents of racial discrimination were so subtle. They were not overt. I certainly would not have had anyone behind closed doors who was necessarily going to be in a position or inclined to tell me what was going on behind closed doors. I did feel isolated. I thought what I had going for me most of all was my credibility, the fact that I had been playing by the rules, not only at this firm but at other firms, and I would be taken seriously. What was most dismaying is that I wasn't taken seriously, that my contributions at that firm were minimized and ultimately ignored. I thought that to the extent the firm had any problems with me, my performance, any grievances they may have had against me, that they would be discussed in the formal setting that had been established. So therefore, the sort of disappointment, this betrayal, probably this feeling of enforced isolation, which ultimately left me powerless within that law firm context, It made my decision that much easier.
So what was the law firm you chose to take on your case?
Oh, the one representing me?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
It was the largest minority firm on the East Coast, and I went to them because I thought that they would understand intuitively what I've been through, and that a firm's first meeting and hearing my story, that they would not say to me, gee, how could they this happen, that they could say, we know how this could happen. So it would save a lot of stress on my part from the beginning. And ultimately, they did an excellent job through the trial.
They're actually... Larry is leaving out a couple of interesting details that it might be worth mentioning, and that is that two legal trade publication articles were influential in making his decision. He the summer that things were really falling apart in 1994 for him at Katten Muchin, the American Lawyer magazine ran a piece about another black lawyer, another classmate of ours from Harvard who literally lived in the same dorm we lived in our first year, who had sued his corporate law firm. In that case, the firm had decided relatively quickly to settle, and there never was a trial. Larry noticed that article, and it gave him the thought, well, if this fella can sue, maybe I've got a case.
This was the son of the Ethiopian diplomat?
That's correct. And then in the local trade publication in Washington, D.C., the Legal Times, the large, predominantly minority law firm that Larry was just describing, which at that time was called Alexander Aponte and Marx, was profiled on the front page of that paper about how they were succeeding and were making great strides. And correct me if I'm wrong, Larry, but as I recall, you read that piece and you said, well, maybe those are the people for me.
Yes, I was impressed.
Yeah.
And so the trial took place. There you were, Larry Mungin. It was not a packed courtroom, but you too were there, Paul Barrett,
right,
observing this trial. What did you think were the most compelling parts of the trial, and why, actually, Larry Mungin's case won?
I think there were two aspects. One was Larry's testimony. His lawyer astutely put him on first to grab the jury's attention. Larry sat there on the stand, clearly a talented person, someone who spoke with authority about how a law firm worked, but who also spoke with authority about his whole life and how it had worked. And I think the jury saw someone who had come to an employer and simply said, I want to work hard, I want to succeed, and strangely, doors remained closed, and he was mysteriously pushed to one side. The second key bit of testimony was that of the several partners in the law firm who came on the stand and offered what I think of as the defense contractor's defense, which is to say, when accused of padding the bills a little bit, the defense contractor says, well, sure, we charge a little bit extra. That's just the way we do things in our industry. Can't blame us. Here, the law firm basically said, well, sure, Larry may have had a bad time. We're not really arguing that. In fact, we're going to put on witnesses, white lawyers, who had just as bad a time. And so the jury saw two things. One, they saw a series of white, well-to-do lawyers making this peculiar sort of confession slash defense. And then there was another absence, another silence. Those other white lawyers who purportedly were going to complain in much the same vein that Larry did simply never were put on the stand. I'm not sure that they really exist.
So, Larry Mungin, you ended up winning. Talk about the jury and the verdict.
Well, when I got on the witness stand, I knew I had a story to tell, and I was just very happy that I would have my day in court and that I could hold the law firm accountable, as I wished I could have held them accountable for before. I wished during the course of my stay at the firm we could have had a formal sit-down evaluation. We could have discussed these things, but I had to confront them at a deposition, and I had to confront them at trial. So I was very, very happy to be able to tell them my story face-to-face there, as well as certainly tell the jury. And I do think there was a connection between me and the jury because there was a clear impression, I believe, of someone who had been playing by the rules and who had been purposefully betrayed. I use that term again. The jury came back, of course, with that sizable judgment in less than 2 hours or so. So they obviously were convinced.
$2.5 million.
Yes, $2.5 million. And my attorneys were very excited. For me, to be honest, and I don't think many people believe me, I was really just happy to have my day in court after those several years of frustration. And what Paul does, I think, very, very well in the book, and it's not surprising since he has so much experience covering the Supreme Court and other legal related, law-related matters, he certainly lays down the day-to-day arguments, the court process, what went on in the courtroom, certainly the what goes on in major law firms. But what I really do like and thought that he did very well and almost surprised me was he really touched on some things that black Americans can identify with, and that is really the struggle to get to the playing field, to get your seat at the table. And he used me as an example of someone who tried and did succeed in doing that. So having convinced the jury, that was very, very important to me. But it was equally as important to me that the trials that I had been through to get to that point were validated, I should say.
Well, you won the $2.5 million, but in the end, you didn't win it because then this was appealed.
Yes, of course. And I expected to be appealed, and I expected if I appealed that it would be appealed, and all of this would go on and on and on. When you go into these lawsuits, you have to have a very clear idea as to what you want out of it. I wasn't out to change the world. I was out to make a point, and that was that they should be held accountable just as I'm always held accountable and you're held accountable, and the rest of us are all held accountable. And fortunately, at that time, I was in a position to do that, at least up through the trial. And on appeal, my lawyers handled the appeal, and we did lose the appeal. And yes, it was a split decision, and the firm can, of course, say that they never discriminate against anyone, and they can all say that. But for me, it was a very, very personal victory, and it fit in very well with my goals, aspirations, and standards in my particular life.
Well, you had three judges, two white Republican judges, one black chief judge. He dissented. The two white judges overturned the verdict. What was the chief justice, the African-American judge's dissent?
Well, Paul certainly analyzed it more than I did. I mean, I saw the ruling. I saw 2-1, and I wasn't surprised. I expected it to be 3-0. I really didn't expect much sympathy from these appellate judges. But Paul, you certainly analyzed his dissent a little better than I did.
This was a very unusual ruling, in that the majority on this three-judge panel did not have a legal basis to overturn the ruling. There was not an action by the trial judge, a statement by a lawyer, a piece of misbehavior by a member of the jury. Instead, then those would all be sort of conventional types of reasons to reverse a jury verdict. Instead, the appellate court used a very rarely used idea in this type of case, and that idea is that no rational juror could look at these facts and come to a discrimination finding. In other words, they say that it would be impossible. We basically push the jury to one side, and we become the jury. We reanalyze the facts. And, of course, that's not in the ordinary course of things what an appellate court is supposed to do. An appellate court is supposed to look at the legal issues and decide those. And you asked about what the basis for the dissent was. It was quite simple. The Chief Judge, Harry Edwards, who, by the way, is himself an expert on labor and employment law, former law professor, said this was a close case. He admitted right away. He didn't say he was enthusiastic about the jury verdict. He simply said, in essence, there's a place for a jury in our legal system, and this jury's finding as to discrimination should be respected and left in place.
And how many members were on that jury?
There happened to be 8, an unusual number, because the trial judge had 6 main jurors, which is pretty standard these days, and then had let 2 additional jurors sit to listen to the case in case any of the 6 had to be taken off the jury for some reason. And then at the end, he allowed all 8 to deliberate.
And how many of those jurors were African-American?
7 out of the 8 were. But I'll tell you something equally important, I believe, and I stress this whenever anybody asks that totally reasonable question. I think it's vital that most of these people on this jury were working class people, several of them were retired, had spent long careers, often in fairly menial positions, and had a long period of time to assess what it's like to work in a large organization. And I think many of them felt that someone who, as Larry says, plays by the rules, someone who follows the procedures and then still is ignored, that there's something wrong with that. And that the law firm's insistence that, well, we may have these formal rules, but in fact, we don't really follow them. In fact, we betray people all the time. That did not go over well with a working class jury.
And so you have this working class jury that the appellate judges said could not have been reasonable, that these jurors could not have been reasonable.
I think anyone who has any exposure to how our legal system works can understand why that's an unusual thing for an appellate court to do. The appellate court, of course, hasn't seen the witnesses, hasn't seen Larry testify, hasn't seen his former employers testify. A Title VII case, a race discrimination case, is always a very subjective case. There's always the question of what did that statement mean? What did that action or inaction mean? And this isn't an antitrust case or a securities fraud case where you have to understand markets or economics. And it's the type of case that in the ordinary course of things, an appellate court will usually respect a jury's decision as to who was telling the truth and who was not.
And I should add that Judge Robertson, the presiding trial judge, had the opportunity to throw the case out at several points and didn't do so.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Judge Robertson, fine judge that he is white.
Well, Larry Mungin, you went from Harvard College and Harvard Law School to a blue chip law firm. You went from being a part of that to suing it, to winning $2.5 million and then losing it on appeal. Where do you stand today? What are you doing?
Well, I do a little work for myself, do a little temp work. I'm sure some of my temp buddies are out there listening. Say hello to them. I'm writing a little bit, as people will see in the book. Paul does a great job describing my family down in South Carolina, the life we have down on the Sea Islands, descended from the Gullahs. There's a lot of work for those of my generation to do. I'm writing about that. There's a possibility I'll get back into law full-time, but who knows? Right now, I'm reassessing things, reevaluating my life, and trying to rebuild it.
It
will be done.
Could you be a part of a corporate law firm in Washington today, or would you want to be?
As for the traditional on-track process, seeing it from both sides, meaning having been an associate of a partner, and then, quite frankly, having sued and heard of the evaluation process and what partners really do think and what they say and how they act behind closed doors, I do think I'm understandably disillusioned about the conventional track life for associates. So, in short, probably not.
The poignant thing, I think, for the moment, while Larry is rebuilding his life, is that if you bumped into him on K Street or Connecticut Avenue, he would appear much the same in that he'll be wearing the same business suit and be walking in and out of the office of major corporate law firms in Washington. But today, as he mentions, he's working for a temporary employment agency on short-term assignments and so forth. So he, again, at least at the moment, is both there and he's not. I mean, he appears to be a lawyer at fancy law firms, but in fact, he's not.
And Paul Barrett, what does this case mean for African-Americans in corporate law firms, their chances of being hired and how they're treated there? I mean, this was an extremely significant case. While most people in the United States may not have heard about it, I'm sure corporate law firms, it registered when he won the largest verdict in a discrimination case involving a black
absolutely.
Law.
It was a very, very big news in the legal community. It received intense coverage in legal publications. What does it mean for black attorneys? It's certainly not an invitation or an exhortation to file suit against your law firm, because Larry's experience shows what a hard and treacherous road that is, and few people would have the amount of success that he had to get even as far as a trial. I think what it says is that people should be very, very cautious, should be very even suspicious of the arrangements that are made with more senior members of law firms, should always be thinking twice and three times. But at the same time, should be trying, as Larry tried, to reach out, to form human relationships, and not to rely necessarily exclusively on the formal rules, because you need to do more than that. Obviously, you need to follow the rules, but you need to also find allies, find mentors, and really probably, sad as it may be to still say this, work harder to succeed.
And Larry Mungin, we only have 30 seconds to ask this big question, but you lived your life until the point of the suit, believing that race should not play a part in how you conduct your life. Do you feel the same way today?
I feel that it shouldn't, but it's real sad to believe that. It still is there, and in ways that I never imagined.
Well, I want to thank you very much, both of you, for joining us. Larry Mungin, who's profiled in the book The Good Black, A True Story of Race in America, just published today. It's written by Paul Barrett, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and it's published by Dutton Books. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and Norman Kelly. Our executive producer, Julie Drizin, Errol Maitland, our technical director, Joe Gill, engineered from Washington. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!